Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com.
We begin with 1 Samuel 14 as we've looked through this book to begin with, coming almost to a halfway point. We've gone from the end of Judges. There was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Then we got introduced to Hannah, and that led us to Samuel, the fall and demise of Eli and his household, the rise of Samuel as a prophet, the height of chapter 7, where Israel was finally worshiping their true and living God that rescued them, that redeemed them from Egypt, put away all their foreign gods. Then chapter 8 comes and they demand a king. The problem of leadership, they rejected God as king, not as Samuel as judge, but God as king. Over the chapters 9 and 11, we see Saul being anointed, proclaimed, then the kingdom actually been established. We see the warning again of chapter 12 from Samuel about them demanding a king and that sinful request. There's repentance. And then chapter 13, finally they have got their king. King Saul is finally their king. We see this introductory statement about that Saul lived 1 year, as we looked at last week, but this is the beginning of his reign as king. But in chapter 13, Saul was rejected. It went from all this building up to be able to have Saul been rejected. So this issue then is, who is going to be the next king? Who is God going to raise up now? We saw the rejection of Eli, but the introduction of Samuel was happening long before, when Eli's house began to crumble. Who will be their king? Who will fill this spot? And we ended chapter 13, looking at this enormous army coming to attack the Israelites, this tiny army of Israelites, one outnumbered 1 to 60, if not more. The heart of the king rebellious against what God had commanded them to do, and they had no weapons. So things are going from bad to worse. We saw the collapse of Eli's house from chapter 2. He was warned. Chapter 4, then he begins to end it with Ichabod. The glory has departed. The ark had been captured. And it's important to remember this passage as we turn to 1 Samuel 14. In chapter 10, Saul had anointed, Samuel had anointed the Lord, and it was only the Lord and Samuel and Saul that knew of this anointing. And most likely this warning that happened in chapter 13 is only known by these three people again, the Lord, Samuel, and Saul. So tonight's chapter, we will look chapter 14 over the next 2 weeks, and almost gives us two different perspectives of the same event. If you were writing a movie about this, you would almost divide these into two different scenes so that you might be able to show different angles of what is happening. And as we've pointed out frequently, 1 Samuel is really a book of contrast from Hannah to Peninnah, Eli to Samuel, Saul. We know that David's coming, this contrast. But even in this chapter, we see a contrast between father and son. We see a contrast between Saul and his son, Jonathan. So we begin the first section of this chapter with Jonathan going missing in verses 1 to 3. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah and in the pomegranate cave at Migron. And the people who were with him were about 600 men, including Abijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people did not know that Jonathan had gone. So we begin this chapter, this end of the last chapter. The Philistines are coming. They're setting up camp at Mishmash. They're greatly outnumbered, these people. So what does Jonathan do? Jonathan, the contrast to Saul, goes and with his armor bearer beside him, says, "Let's go to the Philistine garrison on the other side." But he does this secretly. He goes without telling anybody. The only two people that know about this is Jonathan and his armor bearer. So the garrison they're talking about, we looked at last week, is the one that went out past Mishmash. Maybe his father was not doing anything. They were just waiting to see what would happen. Sitting in a pomegranate cave or next to pomegranate trees, just waiting for this battle to be defeated by itself. Now, this is not a new thing, right? We saw this when Saul went looking for the donkeys. He was quick to maybe just throw in the towel, to turn back home, to not look any further, to continue looking, or even just hiding behind the baggage, running away from the problem that he, the issue, or the thing that he needed to face. But now he's hiding in a cave in Migron. Again, we can't be exactly sure of Jonathan's intentions. We just know that he did this secretly without letting anyone know. He didn't let his father know. He didn't even let the people know. We see this at the end of verse 3. But we see an important factor with this new leadership with Saul in these opening verses. Saul is now king, and we see two things in this verse that should give us great warning. We have Saul as king, but Samuel is not present. Samuel is not with the king. Samuel left in chapter 13, and Samuel's not here at this point. Now, that's a great warning for us to be alert. Samuel has represented the word of God throughout all these chapters, and Samuel's not present. But we also see another thing that should be alarming to us. Abijah is present. Now, you might not know who Abijah is, but we get told who he is. He is the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord in Shiloh. Now, we saw this household, this warning coming, that this warning, this household would crumble, that no one would serve, no one would come in and out of my presence. But who is now the priest underneath Saul? He has reinstated the household of Eli. He's, again, we're seeing this rebellious nature, that he's not making wise choices as king. So Samuel's not there. The word of God, rare in those days without Samuel, but Samuel comes. There's a king, but no prophet. And then we turn back to notice that there's a priest, the bad priest, the Ichabod's brother. Again, the glory had departed, the son of Phinehas, the grandson of Eli. And he's wearing an ephod, the priestly garment. He's not just there helping out where he can. He's actually wearing the linen ephod, the priestly garment, the one that we saw Samuel get brought by his mother Hannah. So now we have a rejected king serving, but we also have a rejected line of Eli serving in the house of the Lord, and no prophet. So our alarm bells should start to ring. We should start be to concerned. And 1 Samuel, again, is answering this question. There was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Now we have a king in Israel, but everyone is still doing what is right in their own eyes. We see this leadership void, this vacuum, which 1 Samuel is seeking to address when they go through this book. Who will be the right leader? Who will serve their capacity as they have been anointed, as the Lord has called them? But this great void is still there. They don't have the right leaders in the right places. At the end of Judges, they have no king. And now they have a king, but it's an ungodly king, a pagan king. So now Jonathan has gone off to the garrison by himself with the armor bearer. And they go now to climbing and planning. First, we'll look at climbing in verses 4 to 7. We'll begin with 4 to 6 to begin with. Within the passes, by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other. And the name of one was Boaz, and the name of the other was Sineh. And one crag rose from the north to front of Mishmash, and the other to the south of Geba. So a crag, I'm not sure, I had to look this word up. It's not a word I use commonly in my everyday vocabulary, but it's a steep, rocky face. And there's two names that were given here, Bozaz, which means slippery, and then sine, which means thorny. So it's not the direct path that you would go. If you were to choose a path, you wouldn't necessarily want to go up the steep rock face that was slippery and thorny, but that's where they're going. It's not a great hiking trail, especially when you're carrying armor and weapons. However, in this ungodly leadership void, we do find Jonathan. We find Jonathan and his armor bearer. Now, this is one of these maybe nameless saints that we might get to meet in heaven. We don't know his name, but he's very, very devoted. We'll look at this a little bit soon. So, Jonathan finds himself an impassable cliff, which he passes with an indefensible army. And he goes in trusting God. And in verse 6, Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised, that it may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." So, Jonathan here, in this leadership void, Jonathan shows this immense amount of faith in the Lord. He understands that the Lord can use many or the Lord can use few. It's not this formula which we've seen in times past where you just apply this certain formula and then the Lord will help you defeat. He says nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few. He doesn't say that it has to be by few. He explains that the Lord is the one that does the saving. So they go to this garrison of the uncircumcised, that they're not in the covenant. They're not within the covenant made from Abraham. So, again, they're not assuming that it may be. It says, come, let us go to the garrison of the uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. It may be the Lord will work for us. He's not assuming that God is some cosmic vending machine where you input these certain formulas and you get it out. He, again, understands God is sovereign and that God can use these circumstances. He might not, but he can. And it may be the Lord would work for us. And again, nothing can hinder the Lord, many or few. Few is two in this instance to be able to take on this mighty garrison. Again, he understands that it's not tactics or people or plans that win, but God who causes the victory. And even when we think about in chapter 13, verse 3, Jonathan is the one who goes in and defeats this garrison of the Philistines before. Now, Saul had 2,000 men at his disposal. Now, Jonathan only had 1,000 in chapter 13. Saul took the credit for this, but it's Jonathan who defeated them, the Philistines. And Jonathan had an army of 1,000. Now, Jonathan has an army of 1 or 2. Depends on how you might want to count them. So, his response is based on faith. He goes in knowing that the Lord is the one that will work it. He doesn't go in thinking that we've earned this. He doesn't go in thinking that we're good people. We deserve this win. He doesn't go in thinking we are strong and we will defeat them. He goes in understanding it's the Lord who brings the victory. So we start to see Jonathan as this great man of faith. Why wouldn't you want him to be king? Why would you reject Jonathan because of the actions of his father? However, we looked at this last week. Jonathan would not make a good king unless God appointed him. And that's the truth, that unless God appointed him, Jonathan would not want to be king. He's going to serve who God chooses because that's what makes him a great man of faith. He does what the Lord tells him to do. He's obedient to the Lord. He trusts the Lord. He sees God's strong hand, his power to defeat and bring victory. He understands that it's God's kingdom. It's not his dad's kingdom. It's not whoever's kingdom or a man's kingdom. It's God's kingdom. So he has no right to claim the throne because he knows it's the Lord who does this work. But we also see the great faith of the armor bearer. In verse 7, and his armor bearer said to him, "Do all that is in your heart, do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul. Isn't that just amazing that this man, this person who was required, would carry his armor into battle. He would be his right-hand man. I'm not sure about army ranks or whatever. If you had a lieutenant, maybe a sergeant would be by his side to help serve him. And this is the man that the armor bearer that was beside him, who would go through after battle to make sure that everyone was dead. He would follow them, carry all the armor that is required. He would be by his side, and he comes with great faith. He could have said, I am out of here. You are crazy. You think we can go take this on? We've barely got 600 men back at camp, and you think you and I can go with you? But he shows great amount of faith, whether that's faith in Jonathan or faith in God. I tend to believe that it's as he looks to Jonathan's faith in God, he's moved to be able to have this faith in God as well. Do all that is in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I'm with you, heart and soul. It reminds you of Ruth's famous line to Naomi in the first chapter of Ruth. Do not urge me to leave, Ruth told Naomi, or turn from following you. For you, where you will go, I will go. Where you will lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you will die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more so, if anything puts death, parts me from you. What a great sense of faith from Jonathan to trust in the Lord, but also this armor bearer following Jonathan's lead. Why would an ungodly man follow a godly man? And I think that's a true thing to stop and consider. Why would an ungodly man follow a godly man into a situation which does require a great amount of faith? So now they go from hiding now to planning. We see this in verses 8 to 9. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men and we will show ourselves to them. He gives them two plans in verse 9 and then verse 10. The first plan, plan A, if they say to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and we will not go up to them. So their plan A is to, if they say wait, we'll stand still and we will not go to them. Their second plan in verse 10, but if they say come to us, then we'll go up. And the Lord has given them into our hand, and this shall be a sign to us. Plan B is, if they say come, we'll come to them, and that'll be a sign that the Lord has delivered them into our hands. Again, you think about God's providence in all of this, that Jonathan has enough faith to be able to believe that the Lord is going to work in those situations, that he knows the providences put before the Lord, that this is a sign from the Lord. As we've seen often, the Lord speaks and the Lord gives a sign to be able to validate what his word is. So here, a sign. So plan A would be a better battle plan, right? They're up in this cliff face with this rocky, steep face with this slippery slope and thorns. If the people started to attack you, you'd have the higher ground. You'd be able to shoot arrows down upon them. They'd be slipping. They'd be falling on thorns. What a great battle plan that would be. But it's the opposite, right? He goes into the worst battle plan. Go up to the garrison where they are, this fort where they are. So there's these two options put before them. So now it's two against an army. We see this in verses 11 to 15. So both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, look, Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. And the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed them after him. And that first strike, which Jonathan and his armor bearer made, killed about 20 men within as if it were half a fur's length in an acre of land. Then there was great panic in the camp and in the field among all the people, the garrison, and even the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked, and it became a very great panic. Now, in the eyes of a movie, this would be an epic battle, the rising of Jonathan and his armor bearer up against this great garrison, these might group of people, this epic battle where two men killed 20, one versus 10, and they defeated him in the first strike. You think about mishmash in 1 Samuel 13, verse 5, and the Philistine mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and troops, like the sand of the seashore, in a multitude, and they came up and encamped at Mishmash, at the east of Beth-Aven. So you have 36,000 people versus 2. The odds that we looked at last week, the impossible odds of 1 versus 60. And now you have these odds of 36,000 versus 2. Just a brief comment that Jonathan says, "Come up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." That he saw his service to the Lord. The Lord is the one that conquers. He is the Lord's servant. He's not serving his father. He's not serving his father's kingdom. It's the Lord's kingdom. It's God's. And he would go in and fight for the Lord. It's not about the strength of these two men. It's not about their tactics, their rituals, the objects they used in battle. But their trust in God to use this situation for God's glory, to bring about defeat. We see that God used this again to cause this great panic. We see this as the Lord's hand with a certain person. We saw this great panic arise in amongst the camp with the Lord in the ark in chapter 5 and 6. This great panic arose in the camp of the Philistines. We saw this again in chapter 7 when the Philistines were attacking the army and they were coming and the Lord thundered and he spoke and there was great panic caused amongst them. We even saw it 2 weeks ago in chapter 12 when Israel was there and Samuel was rebuking them and this great noise and this panic struck the Hebrews, the Israelites. But now it falls again. Again, this sign that the Lord is actually truly with Jonathan. This great panic, this fear, this earthquake, even more panic. The men were shaking as the ground was shaking. And these two men who went in to fight went with them. And the raiders came out. This is what we're speaking of here in that the raiders are there again. Come up after me. Verse 15. The garrison and even the raiders trembled. And these raiders are mentioned in 13, verse 17. And the raiders came up to the camp of the Philistine in three companies. They're all turned outward. And here's the raiders that they're going up to be able to conquer them. And then we see this great battle take place of these two faithful men, but we now go to heightened chaos in verses 16 to 23. And the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude was dispersing here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, "Count and see who has gone from us." And when he had counted, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said to Abijah, "Bring the ark of God here." For the ark of God went at the time with the people of Israel. Now while Saul was talking to the priest, a tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all the people who were with him all rallied and went into the battle. And behold, every Philistine's sword was against his fellow. And there was a great, very great confusion. Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time, and who had gone up with them into the camp, even then they turned to be with the Israelites, who were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, when all the men of Israel who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, they too followed hard after them in battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the Lord passed beyond Beth-Aven. So here we have this great battle going on between Jonathan, his armor bearer, and the garrison. And the watchmen of Saul notice this. They're seeing this dispersing amongst this confusion in this garrison. They're noticing this from a distance. And Paul knows that something is up. Something has gone out to attack them. Someone from his camp. So he finds out who it is. He asks people to number who is there. No longer it's a secret. You just think about this secret thing that he has not noticed, that his son has gone missing. You don't necessarily know this period of time, whether it was a couple of minutes, a couple of hours, a day, or 2 days. You're not really sure of what it is. But it's no longer a secret that Jonathan and his armor bearer are gone. And then in verse 18, we see Saul's reaction to bring the Ark of the God to them. Now, this is almost the exact same tactic that they thought about when they did it in chapter 4, that the Philistines are conquering them. What should you do? Go get the Ark of God and bring it to them. You're reminded of that, the death of Eli's house and Ichabod, the glory departing. And now Saul turns to Abijah and tells him to go get the Ark, the great-grandson of Eli, to go get the Ark, and let's try this tactic again, because it worked so well the last time. But as we're talking, this panic and this tumult increases, so Saul tells him to withdraw his hand. Let's wait. And Saul and his 600 men rushed into battle. Now, the numbers have drastically increased, and even the Philistines were against each other. There was just so much chaos and confusion. We've seen this time and time again. This is one of the ways the Lord defeats the enemies against Israel. It's not necessarily with this enormous army. He just causes this confusion to fall on the army, and they start attacking each other. So, now the Hebrews had been with the Philistines before that time, who had gone up with them into camp. Even they had turned to be with the Israelites, who were with Saul and Jonathan. So, the 600 men have gone into battle with the Philistines, and now we have these other people who were in the camp, the Hebrews that were within the camp of the Philistines, start attacking and joining the side of the Israelites. There's two possible solutions to who these people are. First, they're captives, people, the Israelites who have been taken prisoner before, sent to then fight on the army of the Philistines. That's option number one. Or they're traitors. They're people who have committed treason. They've left their country, home and country, to go serve the Philistines. We don't know exactly sure. But they turn, and now they're fighting the Philistines. So the numbers grow again. So we go from 2 to 600 now to another grown number, which we're not too sure about. Then in verse 22, we see another rise. The men who had hidden themselves in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were fleeing, and they too followed hard after them into battle. So these men that were now camping out in the hills, if you remember, when they started to encamp, the group of the thousands, Saul blows his trumpet, and we're not sure how much the army is at that point, but it goes from 3,000 at the start of chapter 13. Saul blows his trumpet. Most likely more people come to join him in battle. But then the Philistines start coming. The 36,000 start coming, so they all flee. There's a whole group, and they go from at least 3,000 to 6,000, probably a bigger 3,000 to 600. Now they go from the reverse. They go from 600 to add the people, the traitors, or the people who have been taken captive. And then now all the people that were fleeing, see the Philistines are fleeing, so now they come in and start attacking them as well. So this army continues to grow, and the Philistine army continues to shrink as it goes out. So it's these people back in chapter 13, verse 6, that hid themselves in the caves and the holes and the rocks and the tombs and the cisterns. So you had 3,600 Philistines attacking them. We're not sure about numbers now. But also you got to remember that they had no swords. Israel had no forms of swords, so what are they coming in to attack them with? So now we have this big, great army. We went from an army of 1 to 60 ratio. So Jonathan goes in to start attacking them. This ratio shrinks dramatically, but now the ratio is increasing dramatically. So all these problems that we had at the start, this outnumbered aren't, but we still have no sword. So it's interesting to think that only Jonathan and Saul had this sword. So where do they get all this armor from? We're not told exactly in this battle, but I think it's interesting to see how the tables had turned. But the tables turned not because of Saul. Not really because Saul. Saul was there in the pomegranate cave at Migron. It's Jonathan that went out. We see Jonathan, the leader, not Saul. Jonathan's the one that leads and the armor bearer follows. Jonathan's the one that leads and Saul follows. Jonathan's the one that leads and the people follow. Jonathan's the one that leads and the traitors or the prisoners follow. Even the chickens that ran away, the ones that were scaredy cats, they begin to follow Jonathan. But we know that the Lord is the one that's using Jonathan. Verse 23 makes this very clear. So the Lord saved Israel that day. Think back to that statement that Jonathan had told them, "Come, let us go see over to the garrison of the uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing can hinder the Lord from saving by many or by few." And here we see the Lord using very few at the start, but now he's using many to be able to conquer them. So Jonathan's statement's very true. The Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed beyond Beth-Aven. Salvation comes from the Lord. And even during this time, the Lord is still faithful to Israel. You think, remember that in chapter 8, that they didn't reject Samuel because of him being a judge. They rejected the Lord as their king. And the Lord still fights their battles. The Lord still uses godly people like Jonathan to be able to rise up to be able to defeat these Philistines, this army that you wouldn't never have thought about. This impossible army to defeat in this Philistines and walking through this impossible slopes with crags, with thorns, with slippery slopes. We see a lot of connections, but we know what's coming. Sometimes I like to try and think about what it's like not, if you don't know what's following. We know that David's coming up in chapter 15. We know that David is there, David and Solomon, and we know what David's kingship is like. We kind of have this sense, even if we don't know it in detail, we know that David's coming. But what if we were reading through this and we didn't know David was coming? Wouldn't you look to Saul's son Jonathan to be the king? Who is going to fill that leadership void that is there? Is it not Jonathan? Maybe Jonathan will be the new king. Maybe he will be like Samuel, who's the contrast to Saul. One commentator says, "What had been implicit in the Lord sent terror, earthquake, and confusion now is affirmed with this Savior formula drawn from the tradition of holy war." See now, the Lord's hand upon it. We see the Lord working salvation because it has the Lord's hand signature on it. This similar thing that we've seen time and time again. The Lord in chapter 5, the Lord in chapter 7, and even in chapter 12 with him raising up, causing confusion to fall on the camp. But we see this weakness versus strength. The Lord is truly one that uses weakness in all the times. Nothing really special about Jonathan. We don't know how tall he is. We know how tall Saul is. We know that he's in his prime, his choice. We don't know much about Jonathan. But Jonathan goes into battle, trusting the Lord. This battle, 2 verses 3600. And this is so true. When we think about the gospel, we never come to the gospel in all of our strength and our height and our outward appearance. We come to the gospel with weakness, that we cannot fight. We are greatly outnumbered. But it's not about the 1 versus 60. It's not about the 2 versus 3600. It's about the Lord being on our side. And the Lord comes with a king who conquers. Not a king who is sitting by the cave of pomegranates, the king who comes in and conquers, who defeats one man, comes in and lives the perfect life that we could not live and dies the death that we should have died. He rose again on third day, conquering our greatest enemy. We need to be reminded again of this as we think about who is this leader that is coming. We look and it's not found in man through Jonathan. It's the Lord who saves this day. It's the Lord who has delivered them. The Lord saved Israel that day. And again, we're reminded of that every single day. The Lord saves us. We do not save ourselves.
Thank you for listening to this sermon from Seven Springs Presbyterian Church. If you want to learn more about us, please find us on Facebook or visit us at sevenspringspresbyterian.com. Seven Springs Presbyterian Church began in 1874 and is a congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America located in Glade Spring, Virginia. Please join us for worship on Sunday at 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. for His glory and His gospel.